Hello, hello. Okay. Welcome. This is what's new with OS deployment in Configuration Manager and the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. Unfortunately, it looks like we lost a lot of our audience to at least the one, if not two, other OSD sessions that are going on right now. I apologize for that. Obviously, folks didn't look at the full session list very well and see that we were double booked like this. So I apologize for that for those of you that had to make a hard choice, but I appreciate those of you that came here for the live session instead of catching it later. My name is Aaron Chakowski. I'm a senior program manager on the Enterprise Client Management team. That's the engineering team that does System Center Configuration Manager, Windows Intune, as well as the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, and a few other things. Today, talking about what's new with OSD, both in System Center 2012 R2 Configuration Manager and the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit 2013, both of which were released last year. So I'll be talking about what's new in those versions, and I'll also be talking a little bit about some of the current activities that are going on right now. I want to be clear also about what this session is not. I won't be giving a basic overview of the products themselves. So I'm assuming this is a level 300 session. So I'm assuming some knowledge of the products themselves, or at the very least of OS deployment capabilities and concepts. And unfortunately, I'm also not going to be talking really about any future stuff. We're just not there yet, not ready for that. If you have any questions, I've got a lot of stuff to get through today, so if you have any questions, please just jot them down and come find me afterwards. You could also hit me up on Twitter at Aaron Chakowski or hashtag Tina14OSD to just comment on things or ask questions or what have you. So I'm going to start talking about MDT and some of the new things that are, or sort of what's new with MDT right now. So as I mentioned, we released version 2013, last year in 2013. That meant that we released an updated installer, updated release notes, and some revisions to our documentation. So it's all in the download center. Search for MDT 2013. It's all in that one download. You'll get all that stuff. What that is really is it's new support for the Windows 8.1, Windows 8.1 ADK that comes along with that, as well as the new version of Config Manager with 2012 R2 that was released last year. And so really the key thing here is that new support for those new platforms. By taking dependency on the new version of the ADK, that did mean that we had to drop support for a few platforms. So XP and Vista are no longer supported, as well as older versions of Config Manager. I'm going to kind of plow through some of these initial slides. It's stuff that I've presented before and I've talked about before, but I just wanted to kind of go over it again and cover it just to make sure that everyone's clear on this. So MDT 2013 is the current version. MDT 2012 Update 1 is still available and still supported. So you can go out to the download center and download the previous version of MDT. Why would you want to do that? Well, like I said, MDT 2013 leverages the Windows 8.1 ADK. The ADK has an N-2 support policy. So that means that the ADK will support deployment and servicing of the N platform for the 8.1 ADK, that's Windows 8. -2, that means it goes back to Windows 7. Config Manager 2012 R2 is also leveraging the 8.1 ADK, so MDT 2013 aligns with that version of Config Manager. MDT 2012 Update 1 supports both the Windows 8 ADK as well as the Windows 7 AIK. So if you then follow the N-2 rule on both of those, you can see which platforms that those would support. So I bring this up just to let you know that, hey, the other version is still out there, it's still available, it's still supported. But also, since the new functionality with MDT 2013 is really just around supporting Windows 8.1, if you're still deploying Windows 7 or Vista, you know, they're out there, I know they exist, or you're still working with older versions of Config Manager, then upgrading to MDT 2013, honestly, may not actually gain you much. In fact, if you're still deploying Vista, it's actually going to hurt you because it's not a supported platform with MDT 2013. So there are some minor bug fixes that were taken as well, but really the main focus of it was supporting Windows 8.1. please read the release notes. I know oftentimes, you know, I hear a lot of people say, oh, I don't read those. I don't look at that. We have to make some hard choices sometimes, and there are instances where we know that there are things that we're just not going to have time to fix before we release, but we know that there's a workaround, and that's actually comes into part of the decision-making process of what we fix before release. So we'll put that information in the release notes. So oftentimes I get a bunch of questions from folks on topics like, hey, I tried this and it doesn't work. And I'm like, have you read the release notes? It's in there. It explains the problem and it gives you a workaround. It tells you how to handle it, how to mitigate it. So I just wanted to kind of whip through a couple of these of note. I mentioned that the documentation is also available for download from the Download Center. The help files that are in products, so when you install MDT 2013, it'll add, you know, the chum files on the disk. Those are still from MDT 2012 Update 1. Most of the content in there hasn't changed. Most of the functionality is the same. You'll see a lot of the strings are still for the old version. But if you want the latest and greatest documentation, get the doc files from the download page. With GPO packs, we're no longer shipping the Security Compliance Manager components as part of MDT. We had some issues with redistributing that. So the capability is still there in the scripts and how it functions, how it uses those. It just doesn't, sorry, my laptop's going to sleep. That would be bad for later. It just does not, it just does not provide all that content by default. So what you need to do is, if you want to use those integrated GPO packs, just go and get Security Compliance Manager and install it. And the release notes provide information on how to make all that work. And in fact, that actually, I think, provides somewhat of a better story because Security Compliance Manager, their release of the GPO packs are a little further behind the release of MDT as well as the release of Windows. So being able to provide support for the latest version of those GPO packs would have to come later. So, and in a lot of cases, a lot of customers will customize them anyways. So in some respects, it just made more sense. Check for updates. So in short, we're gonna deprecate the components tab inside of MDT. If you're familiar with MDT, in the console, there's the components node where it lists a lot of the, in some cases required, in some cases beneficial tools. I guess we're missing a good show next door. and because of some changes that we didn't make in MDT 2013, and the fact that we're deprecating it, if you check for updates, it'll actually revert to an older list. So you'll get the list from MDT 2012, update one. So it's safe to say just don't use it. There was an issue with the ZTI server task sequence on UEFI systems. This actually was an issue with the config manager code and should now be fixed if you apply 2012 R2 CU1. There's some issues with the configure ADDS step for configuring Active Directory domain services. A lot of those are easily mitigated by making some variable changes in the custom settings.ini. And there are some UBI settings that are missing from the N10.xml. So look at the release notes, and it spells out exactly what you need to do. There's just some additional entries to add in to the unattend.xml. Otherwise, when you deploy Windows 8.1, when it goes through the UBI process, you'll actually be prompted in a couple of spaces, which obviously is not what you want when doing an automated deployment. A couple other issues to bring up that aren't in the release notes. The first one's not so much an MDT issue as it is a Windows issue, where if you do a deployment, and especially I think if you do copy profile, if you use copy profile, the user accounts will come up with only 5 tiles, which obviously is not as many as it should have. And that was fixed as part of Windows 8.1 update that just came out last month. And there's one instance still where you could hit this, and that's covered in the KB article that I list up here. The other one of note is in MDT on the task sequence, if you use OS conditions, so on the conditional tab, setting a condition to specify a specific OS, you'll see that Windows XP is still there, which obviously is not supported, but hey, you can still choose it as a condition. And Windows 8.1 is not there. So obviously just one Surface that we missed as we were going through. There's an easy workaround for that. You can query WMI for the OS version. So what are we doing right now? There's a big push across Microsoft to make our products accessible and allow anybody to use them at the same level as everyone. So with MDT, we have started a process to make MDT as accessible as possible. Now, there are certain aspects of it that we're limited. When you're in Windows PE, it doesn't have certain accessibility features like the narrator or the magnifier or other aspects to make it accessible. But we're doing what we can to make the console, the workbench accessible, the deployment wizard, things like that. So the VPAT is a standard document that outlines how a product is accessible and maybe what areas it's not as good at that. And that's all published on the Microsoft 508 site. 508's the US federal standard for accessibility. So if you're a federal government customer, this is probably a big thing. Or if you're a large environment and you have accessibility requirements, it's now something that MDT will support. And we'll continue to work on this over time. We know there are some issues with it, and that's documented in that VPAT. Don't ask me what it stands for, I don't remember. And so we're working on going through test passes of the product, looking for ways in which it's not accessible. We have a ton of standardized tests for this. And then we'll start to phase out or phase in additional support for that over the next number of releases. Oh my gosh, we're moving the documentation to TechNet. This is a process we started a while ago. As I mentioned, we sort of deprecated that inbox documentation, the CHUM files. Those weren't updated with this last release. In talking with our content folks, handling doc files, handling CHUM files is a big burden on them. And they obviously do most of their work on TechNet. And that certainly, I would hope, helps you as well to be able to have that documentation easily accessible on TechNet on the web. So we're currently going through a process with a vendor to get all of those doc files converted into our documentation management system, which then would allow them to be published to TechNet, which obviously is the end goal. And they're still working on it. There's a lot to go through. Right now they're processing through the using MDT doc as well as the toolkit reference. They're two of the larger docs, so they've got a lot of stuff to get through. I don't have a date yet as to when that'll be available, but I'm hoping it should be soon. And I'll certainly make a lot of announcements once that's available. By moving this to TechNet, that'll mean that the in-product documentation, as well as what we release with the installer on the download center, those will go away in the future. But we also understand that there are instances where you need docs offline. If you're in a lab environment or a server environment where you don't have a network connection and you need to get to the documentation. So we'll work with our documentation team on coming up with a plan for that. But as of right now, I don't know what that'll be. But it is something that we do understand is a need. And then finally, how MDT is supported is something that we have tried to define, and we've listed in this KB article, 287-2000. That's your home for the support plan for MDT. So it'll talk about the current versions that are supported. It'll talk about the current versions that aren't, or the older versions that aren't supported. And that's where we'll make revisions. Anytime we make revisions to our support plans, or if we add things, or that sort of thing. So make sure to bookmark that and go to that as your home for how MDT is supported. With that, we do have a sustained engineering plan in place. So if perchance there comes a time where there's a critical bug in MDT that can't be a tweak in a script or something of that sort, if we need to release a hotfix, we do have a process in place by which we can do that. That would still follow normal channels as with any product, call support, work with them, request the hotfix. But we do have that capability with MDT. And if you have bugs or feedback that you want to request for the future, for a future version, You can go to the Connect site. It's the same Connect site as Configuration Manager, vNext. There's a group under there for MDT. So you can file feedback there. That can be, hey, change this functionality, or hey, when I click on this thing, every time I click on this thing, it gives me this error. just keep in mind, though, that anything filed on Connect is for the future. It's not a, hey, I need this fixed today. That's when you want to call support. So Windows 8.1 update just released last month. With that also came a revision to the ADK. If you go out to the Download Center and look for the Windows 8.1 ADK, you'll see only this version. So it's not a new ADK, it's a refresh of the 8.1 ADK. So what does that mean to MDT? Well, we would recommend that you upgrade it, but you don't have to. It's not required. So if you have MDT 2013 running and functional and happy with an existing 8.1 ADK installed, you're fine. It'll continue to work, and it's continued to be supported as well. It's a supported scenario. Now, if you do upgrade the ADK, you need to think about a few things. First, if you're using USMT, you should update your deployment share. You should refresh your deployment share to make sure the USMT content is updated. There's a couple of minor bug fixes that you want to make sure you're using that newest version. Windows PE, you don't need to update the deployment share for Windows PE. It's because the 8.1 ADK does not include the newest version of Windows PE. There's a process by which you take the existing 5.0 Windows PE in the ADK and you upgrade it to Windows 5.1. Well, that's not something that MDT today natively can support. It requires some additional work to do that and some order of operations that today MDT isn't natively able to do. Finally, make sure you get the latest 8.1 install source. So if you're getting your ISOs from MSDN or the Volume License Center or you know wherever you get your media from, hopefully it's one of those two places, make sure you go out and get the latest for 8.1 update. By now, they should all be updated with the latest and greatest. So if you're doing 8.1 deployments, please go and get those latest bits. Why? So it is possible to service an 8.1 image to include the April update. But there's some challenges around that. If you're using MDT and you want to add that update, don't add it into the packages node like you would with any other update. The reason is that we can't guarantee the order of updates that get applied. They get added to the unattended XML for processing, and we can't ensure that they'll process in the right order. And there is a prereq for the 8.1 update. So you have to make sure that things are done in the right order. You could create them as applications to install online during your task sequence, and that then will make sure that you have things ordered correctly. Certainly, you can always crack the whim yourself with DISM on the command line and stuff in those packages manually. And because of those reasons, I just would like to reiterate, go get the latest source. It just makes everything a lot easier. WinBoot, I'm not going to talk much about this, just that MDT doesn't support it. And really, that's because Windows PE 5.1 is needed to deploy WinBoot, and we don't have a supported process by which you can ingest that Windows PE 5.1 boot image. Now, Michael had a little fun on a weekend, and he made it work. So he documented that on his blog, and the link is here. It's on his personal blog, not a supported process. But it is technically possible if you want to play around with it. And this is all up on the MDT product blog. MS Deployment is the name of it. And there's a lot more detail up there if you're interested in more. OK, so that's all I'm going to talk about for MDT. I'm not going to do any demos. Again, not a whole lot changed with MDT visually or functionally. So I'm not going to waste your time going through and showing you where we added new strings for 8.1 or that sort of thing. So I'm just going to plow ahead and move on to OSD. I talked about this last year at TechEd, and so nothing much here has changed since then. We added support for 8.1, both as a platform and at the ADK level. We added the capability to import older boot images. So because of the compatibility with the ADK and its N-2 support, we added in support for older boot WIMs, so you could still deploy older operating systems. Added support for virtual hard disks, and as well as some new task sequence steps. And I'll talk more about those in a bit. So this chart is something I put together with someone on the Windows research team to try and visualize the different products over on the left in green, the different config manager versions, which ADK those align to, natively align with, which components that we rely upon that are intrinsic to that version of the ADK, and then what platforms those support. And then depending upon which version, then you have the ability to import other versions of Windows PE or even other versions of USMT that would support other platforms. So both if you're on 2012 SP1 or 2012 R2, even though natively they only support certain platforms, by adding in other boot images, you have the capabilities of deploying a wide breadth of operating systems. And certainly, like with SP1, that requires some CUs to be installed. But it does give you that wide breadth of capability. Someday, I will post this on our blog. I've been saying that now for about a year, I think, but that's my goal. Okay, so let's talk about virtual hard disks. Again, some of the stuff I talked about last year, I'll whip through some of this scenario stuff, and I'm actually going to do a demo a little more in depth than what I've done in the past, and so we'll actually get into the depths of it and see how it works. So why would you want to create a VHD in Config Manager? Well, it's a great way to test stuff, right? And a lot of you might already be doing this, of running your task sequence inside of a VM just to make sure it works and run it through its paces. That's basically what we're doing, is we're running the task sequence inside of a VM, and then we're saving that output of the VHD that's created. Plus, you can integrate this into your data center to be able to export those VHDs into a data center environment, either a Hyper-V environment or using VMM. We have the capabilities also of uploading to VMM. When you create the VHD, you do have to have the Hyper-V console installed on the same system as the Config Manager console. So when you're creating the VHD inside of the Config Manager console, it relies upon the underlying Hyper-V components to process that and actually create the VM and boot it and do stuff to it. So it does need that. I'm not saying install Hyper-V on your Config Manager server. I would not recommend that. This is definitely an instance of having a remote console on even a Windows 8 system, which is what I'll be demoing. To create the VHD, we created a new task sequence template, and I'll walk you through that here in a second, as well as the ability to modify a VHD. So if you just want to add an application to it, or you want to add some updates, you can do all of that offline, well, more or less offline. The application is actually online, but without having to completely recreate that VHD, you can service that all and modify it in console. All right, so let's do a demo. All right, so I have a 2012 R2 site, and I just noticed I have 11 days left on my eval copy here, so good timing. First, I'll walk through how we create our task sequence. So we're opening up the wizard, and you can see we have a new option here, the third option, to install an existing image package to a virtual hard disk. So I'll select that. Our menu changes. We'll just call it task sequence one, that's fine. Select the boot image. Which OS do I want to install? Oh, sure, I'll install 8.1. A lot of the same sort of stuff that I'll just leave for the sake of demonstration. Again, just for sake of typing. We install the clients. We can add some additional parameters if we want. Install applications. We can pick from a list to install the applications into that VHD. I'll skip this for now. And we're good to go. So I'm going to cancel out of this because I have already created a task sequence. There it is. So if we look at this, we can see it's referencing all the packages. And obviously, the OS image is the bulk of the content at a little over 3 gigs. But then we've got some other content. So total, we're looking at probably, let's say, 3.5 gigabytes of data, right? So I'm running this, let's say I'm running this on a desktop, and you know, there's other things installed, it's doing other things. Do I really have 3.5 gigs of space available to create that VHD? Well, wait a minute. The way we actually create that VHD is using our media generation process. We're actually gonna create an ISO, and then use that ISO, we're gonna hook that to a VM to create the VHD. So in reality, you need double the space. Plus, you know, enough room for scratch for a little flex space, right? So we have 3.5 gigs of content. Well, that really means we probably need double, more in, let's say, 7 or 8 gigs of space. Now, on this system, I actually have quite a bit of space, 37 gigs free. But let's say I only had 7 gigs. And I'm like, wow, that's cutting it a little close. It might work, but are there other things that might be needed, or just, you know, some temp space for Windows? Well, I've got my external drive here, and it's got 100 gigs free, over 100 gigs free. How can I use that? Wouldn't it be great if I could leverage that? Well, guess what? You can. But wait, there's more. So the way we process our media, so I'm going under the system control panel and then opening up the advanced properties. And down here at the bottom, we have the environment variables. In the environment variables is the TMP variable. And I've already modified it to a different path. When Config Manager, when the console creates media, it looks at this variable. So if you change this variable to another path, then it'll use that space, it'll use that drive for where it creates the media. So it's a great way to be able to redirect media creation to a separate drive. Okay, so I know I can use now that big drive to do all this. So let's go ahead and create a VHD. So I'll right-click on virtual hard disks. The option to create the VHD is lit up, so I know that everything's working. If the Hyper-V console was not installed on this system, that would be grayed out. I wouldn't even have the option to start the wizard. So I'll just give it a quick name here. And I'm going to put it on my server, win81.vhd. OK, so which task sequence do I want to use? Well, I better use the one that I just created. So let me check that. It's going to show me all of the content that's associated with that. I'll choose the distribution point that I want. And then I'm basically good to go. OK? It just occurred to me I didn't show you the task sequence. Sorry. Let's take a look at that first before I run it. So this is the default template for creating a VHD. Doesn't do much, right? Applies the OS, or you know, petitions it, applies the OS, runs a setup Windows, installs some apps, shutdown. Pretty simple. The shutdown is the key piece. Once you get into this, I'll explain more as to why, but I just wanted to give you a quick look at what the task sequence is actually doing. All right. Make sure I've got everything. Let's get that started. All right. I'm not going to spend the rest of the session sitting here watching progress, because this is going to take a while. But you can see at least one thing that's going on right now. Is we've started some log files. And you can see the create TS media. So we're using our media functionality. So let me step back to the deploy to VHD. So we have a new log file for deploying to VHD. And in here, you can see where we have the call to create media. And then here's the path out to that ISO, out on our G drive. OK? And then in the media log, it's processing through all the packages. So it's checking to make sure all the packages are there, getting all that content prepped. So it's going to take a few minutes for that to process. In our wizard, we've flipped over to a progress indicator. Again, this is going to take a while. So what actually is going to happen here is it's going to go through and create that ISO file. That's going to be the first chunk of it. Once it does that, it creates the actual VHD file, an empty VHD, creates a VM inside of Hyper-V, attaches the VHD, gets all that ready, mounts the ISO to that VM, boots the VM, The ISO runs. At that point, it's just a normal OS deployment. It's just a VM, just some media, just running a task sequence. At the end of that, the task sequence will shut it down. Once we detect that the VM has shut down, we actually destroy the VM. It's a temporary VM. We clean up the media, so the ISO goes away. And then we create the virtual hard disk package using that VHD that was created. So all of that processing will take some time. Take some time to stage the content, take some time to create the ISO, create some time to actually deploy the system into that VHD. So while that simmers, let's go take a look at the modify. So in a very Julia Child's-esque way, I have already created a VHD. So we can see here we have some options. We can schedule updates. This is, honestly, it's identical to scheduling updates on an OS image. Not much difference there. I'm not going to waste your time going through that. So let's look at the option to modify. It looks very similar to the previous wizard, but you can see here at the bottom the path is locked. We can't change that path. So we're only going to be modifying that existing VHD. We can change the metadata on it if we want. Which task sequence do you want to use? Well, I have one for modifying it. Honestly, I'm not going to take the time to show you what's in it. It's just it's two steps: install applications and then shut down again. We choose our DP and we're done. I'm not going to go ahead and start this because we already have the other process running, and I don't want to completely kill it. So I just wanted to show you kind of what the process is for modification. What it would actually do in this case is it would create a VM, mount the VHD to it, boot the VM, start the task sequence in that. We would install the application. The TS would then shut down the computer. We would detect that. We'd destroy the VM, and then we'd bring the VHD back in. This is ideal because you're not recreating that VHD again. It's a quicker process. We're not having you go through the other process of creation to have to create the ISO and go through all that work just to add an additional application. Okay, and then just real quick on the upload to VMM. I don't have it installed, so it's a poor demo here, but I just wanted to show you what this looks like. It's very straightforward. You specify your VMM server, you specify your library, and you push it there. There's not a lot of bells and whistles here. Upload to VMM, yep. So the question is sort of reiterating what I just said, I think, is it's just uploading to VMM. There's no additional work inside of VMM. There's no additional integration with VMM. It's literally just pushing that VHD up into the VMM library. All right, so this is still churning on creating and getting all the content. So let me flip back over to the deck. We'll let that simmer a little bit, and we'll talk about the next topic. So we wanted to try and bring some additional parity in OSD as there is in MDT. So there's a bunch of steps that are native to MDT that a lot of customers will just natively, just automatically, when they do Config Manager, they automatically install MDT and integrate it in order to get some of the functionality from MDT. So what we'd like to do is maybe get to the point where not everybody has to do that. Certainly, there's a lot of reasons why you would want to do that. But if we can eliminate some of those, then you may not have to go the route of integrating MDT. There might be some benefit there. So in this release, we looked at three steps. The first one in MDT is called validate. In Config Manager R2 is called check readiness. Literally, it's the same step. If you look at them side by side, they're identical. They do the same checks. And the reason here is to prevent, let's say you target a task sequence inappropriately or a system is in the wrong collection. You don't want a server to get a Windows 7 deployment. That's a bad thing, right? Well, this can help block that. So it'll fail the TS at the very first step if it's not the right platform. Or just preventing late failures, making sure that, hey, this system doesn't have enough disk space and we know it'll fail. So it'll fail eventually in a more disastrous location, like when it's trying to apply the WIM. So if we can fail it early and make and ensure the user is still have a functional system, that's a good thing. The run PowerShell script in MDT, run PowerShell script in Config Manager. It's a perfect name for it. This allows you to run a PowerShell script, so you can specify a PS1. We made one tweak here, is we added the ability to specify execution policy at runtime. So instead of having to add an additional step in your task sequence to change the execution policy, you can do it right there in that step. Finally is gather, which is a pretty powerful step. It's a simple but powerful step in MDT. We brought it into Config Manager R2 and called it set dynamic variables. It's not exactly the same as gather. It's based on gather, based on a true story. What it does is it gives you the ability to create a more dynamic task sequence. Now, you can kind of do that today in OSD to a degree. You can set task sequence variables. You can set conditions on steps. But if you want to do a bunch of those at once, you have to add a lot of steps into your task sequence. So we're now able to accomplish this in a single step. And I'll show you what that means in a second. Additionally, when you run this step in your task sequence, it will gather and set some additional task sequence variables underneath the hood. Unfortunately, we don't do a good job of documenting this. We do have a doc bug to get this documented. It's not on TechNet. It's also here. So you know, get it from the slides later. But there's 8 new variables that get set when you include this step. If you don't include this step, you're not going to see these variables. You can include this step. You do have to, when you add this step, you do have to set a variable. You have to do something with it. You can't just add this step. But that doesn't mean you have to do anything real with it. You could add a bogus variable just for the sake of getting these other 8. And there are things like, if you can't read it from the back, make, model, MAC address, IP address, default gateway, serial number, asset tag, and UUID. All sorts of things that you can use to identify a system or identify a group of systems. So with that, let's see what that actually looks like. But first, our process here has moved on. We can see in the log file here, we are creating our ISO. We're calling OSCDIMG. And our path to the ISO, down at the bottom there on G. So if we real quick just hop over there and take a look, we're creating our ISO. So that's churning. Let's let that churn. All right, so I have created a demo task sequence. Ignore the words tech ready. We're using a demo from another conference. So this is the check. I've added our 3 new steps to demonstrate those. So the first one, this is check readiness. If you're familiar with validate from MDT, you'll notice that it's very similar. You can specify memory, processor speed, disk space, and then the toggle there at the bottom is client or server. If the system will evaluate those at runtime when it hits this step. If any of these checks fail, any of the checks that are selected, if any of them fail, it fails the task sequence. You still have the option here to continue on error, but you're effectively making this step worthless. So don't do that. All right, here is set dynamic variables. Let me try and expand this out so you can see what's going on here a little better. I'm going to focus on the stuff that I've already added, and then I'll talk about some of the new stuff or the additional controls. So this is an example, trying to make it more of a functional example of how you might use this. So we can specify multiple rules, and then if those rules are met, we'll set some variables. So in this example, we're leveraging the default gateway variable, or we also call it location. So the idea is I've got a bunch of network locations, and depending upon the network location that I detect, I want to specify some specific information that then controls what the outcome is. So in this case, if it's on the 192 segment, well, we're going to specify the OU as in this case, it's in Germany. And we'll specify the specific OU for that region. We'll specify a specific config file just for that, you know, that has all of the locale settings specified in it. And we'll set the time zone. So we make sure that the time zone is accurate. But if it's on the 10 segment, well, that's in the US, so we'll specify that OU and the right on a 10 and the right time zone. For the sake of this demo, I'm also setting that custom one value as true. So that'll come up again later. So some of the controls we have here to add a rule, which are the if statements up above, we have a few options. You can do a rule as to whether it's a specific computer. This will look for MAC address, UID, computer name. And so you can specify specific variables for a very specific computer. The location is the one that I'm already using here in the demo. Make and model is exactly what it sounds like. You know, it's a Dell Latitude, whatever. And then task sequence variable. So you can key off of other variables. If you know that there's a variable that already exists and it's going to have a certain value, set a rule for that, and then set some other variables based upon that. You don't have to add rules. You could just add variables. So let's say that you want to set a whole bunch of task sequence variables in your task sequence. Today, well, with 2012 SP1, I should say, you would have to include multiple set task sequence variable steps, or do a script or something that would do that, you know. But it's a lot of work to set a whole bunch of task sequence variables. With this, you could not include any rules and just do a whole bunch of set variable steps, and that'll set all of those variables in one step. So we have two options here. We can set a custom variable where you specify the name. It's entirely up to you. You can choose your own name, or you can, if you choose the name of a known variable, it'll use that. Okay, so this is not, it's custom, but it's also for any existing variable. But it's basically you customizing what that variable name is, what the value is. You can make it secret if you want. We also have the option to pick from existing variables. Now, the power here is that it's a multi-select, but we also give you a list of the variables that you could set. So in some respects, this is kind of a good lookup tool. If you need, you know, if you, oh, hey, there's some variable, I don't remember exactly what it's called, but it's for BitLocker. Well, add this task, open up this UI and search for BitLocker, and it'll show you those ones. So you can choose all of these. It's most of the variables that you can set during a task sequence. I say most because there are a few exceptions. We didn't include variables that are arrays. One in particular that I can think of or I know of is the OSD adapters variable. Depending upon how many adapters you have in the system, it will append an array ID and then the rest of the variable name after that. It was something we discussed and we decided to not include it in this release, but it's something that we'll look at in the future. If it is something that you do want to include, it's very easy to do so by just adding it as a custom variable and specifying that full name here, OSD adapter 0, blah, 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 blah. So you can still use those, it's just not available from the picker. Okay, finally we have the run PowerShell script, where I'm specifying a package that contains a script that I list by name. I include a few parameters where I'm just passing my name in, and then that'll show up in the logs when I actually run it. And then we have our execution policy. And the three that we support are all signed, undefined, or bypass. So those are the three execution policies that you can set at runtime in this PowerShell script. Excuse me. So as part of this demo, remember we set that custom one variable under set dynamic variables. If I come to the conditions of the run PowerShell script step, I have a condition that it'll only happen if custom one is true. So if the system that I'm running on is in the right location, that variable will get set, the script will run. All right, so I've already gone through the process of deploying this task sequence just for the sake of time and have actually already run it. So we will see it on the installation status as already being run. I just wanted to make sure it worked for you guys, right? So we're actually going to do a reinstall. This is just running that task sequence again. We'll see it whip by here pretty quick. It'll run through those three steps, and we're done. Wahoo. So let's take a look at what that actually did. So we have our task sequence log. pop up to the top. All right, so here we see we have our check readiness section. Check the memory, validated successfully. Processor, disk space, client, it's all validated successfully. So this is what you would see in the log. If any of those failed, it would then fail the step, which would fail the task sequence, and everything would fall out from there. We skip forward, we see here's our set dynamic variables. Don't go too far. Here you can see those options it's gathering. It's gathered the MAC address, the IP address, yada, yada, yada. Okay, so it's got all that stuff, and as this step, then it's dumping that to the log so that you can see that. You can then see at the bottom here, it's evaluating the rules. So it's evaluating the expressions that are specified. The first one there, it validates to false. The condition is evaluated to false because it's not in the 192 default gateway. Then at the bottom, it's cut off just a bit. Sorry. We have, it checks the string with the 254. Well, that condition's evaluated to true. So those dynamic variables in that group then are set. So as we come down a little further, right before it runs the next step, the task sequence engine will check the evaluation of, it'll evaluate that condition. So you can see it expands the string, what it should be, run PowerShell script, the condition for the action is evaluated to be true. So that value is set, it matches what's on that step, so it's going to go ahead and run that step. Then here in our PowerShell script, we'll throw a warning to let you know that you're setting bypass or something as the execution policy, not a good general security guideline. So we just want to make sure to warn you of that. Grabs the package. This is all package processing stuff. And then we actually execute the script down here. Executes the command. It gets a good return zero. We'll dump the output of that script into the task sequence log. So what you see here, you can see the parameters, and then everything below there, that's actually what the script is doing. So the script, it's a very simple script that just dumps a bunch of variables out to the console. So that's then coming through into the log file. So that's very useful as you're troubleshooting things. You'll be able to see that console output in the log file. So that's it. That's what that guy does. While we're here, let me close out of this, and let's flip over and see how our deployment is going. All right, so the media creation was a success. All right, and the deploy to VHD log has moved on. You can see here, attaching the VHD to the VM, attaching the media to the VM, waiting for the VM to stop. So let's go look at Hyper-V here. We can see, so this is actually my config manager server. And then here's this temporary VM that was created. You can see in the thumbnail at the bottom, but I'll connect to it so you can see full screen what's going on. Maybe. There we go. It's running the task sequence. So it's nothing fancy here. We're applying that OS. Once this is done, then it'll discard that VM and create the package. So that's kind of underneath the hood what's happening with the create virtual disk. All right. Let's hop back to the deck. So again, we have some release notes for R2. A couple things to look at there. If you're using multicast enabled DPs in 2012 SP1, if you upgrade to R2, those DPs, or the multicast will stop working on those. I think it's SP1 CU3. If you apply that first before the R2 upgrade, we included a fix in that CU so that multicast should continue to work after the upgrade. The other workaround there is just reinstall a multicast, which I understand can be a problem in a big environment that uses a lot of multicast. The good news is that the fix, it's a setup fix, so we shouldn't see it again in the future because we fixed, that was part of the fix in CU3 was to effectively fix setup so that when setup runs, it'll handle it appropriately. The next one, it actually affects both OSD as well as MDT. There is an Apex cleanup maintenance task, a scheduled task in Windows 8.1 that will do some APEX cleanup. And if that runs prior to sysprep, then bad things will happen. You'll have some problems with your applications, with language, especially multi-languages, and some other things with your modern apps. So that maintenance task by default, we worked really closely with Windows to ensure that the scenario would work out of the box. It'll wait, I think it's 60 minutes before it runs, and then it waits like 15 minutes for idle time. So you have like 75 minutes after the OS comes up and before sysprep runs. So if your deployment process takes more than an hour, you might want to look at your deployment process. Also, there's an easy way just to add a step in to disable this task. And that will then take care of it. So that once sysprep runs, it's not affected by the task. And after sysprep, Windows will automatically re-enable it. So you don't have to worry about any downstream effect there. Cumulative update one for R2, the KB is there in blue, fixed a lot of stuff. We had a lot of hot fixes that we released after the release of R2. There's about five of them there that I'm listing. In the first two, it's actually the same hot fix that was released that fixed two separate issues. But I wanted to note this because aside from those existing hot fixes that were rolled up into CU1, we added some additional fixes. Namely, the USB fixed disk issue. So there's a new Windows 8 requirement that USB disks now show up as fixed disks in Windows as opposed to removable disks. And the impact to Config Manager customers is that when you go to create media and use USB, we block fixed disks because we don't want you to, we're trying to help to not do that on a local drive or a larger USB drive that you may not want to blow away. But that obviously isn't going to work anymore. So we added a fix where we'll now allow you to create media to a USB fixed disk. You have to say that very carefully. Also, there's some sorting issues, both in the offline servicing of an image, as well as optional components for boot images. So if you go into R2 without CU1, and you go into schedule some updates, and you click a few, and then you resort the list, and then you click a few more, it'll actually start selecting other updates. It's kind of a fun bug. Same with the optional components. It's fun from a usability standpoint, not from an outcome standpoint. It's obviously bad from an outcome. Same with the optional components is if you select an optional component and then sort the list, while it still might show you've selected the same one, underneath the selection changes. So like if you select .NET and then sort the list, it'll actually be selecting something else. So that's obviously bad. So we fixed that in CU1. I didn't hear any reports of customers actually hitting that. That's something we found internally. There's also a lot more in CU1. There's a lot of fixes in a lot of other areas, not just OS deployment. So hit that KB article and check it out. I do have to caveat this to be nice to the support folks. This is like any other hotfix. I'm not gonna recommend that you run out and install CU1 on everything. Maybe some others in the community who I won't name would say absolutely you must install this. Different recommendations, different guidance, but product team recommendation, engineering team recommendation is you only apply it if you have the problem. So if you're not experiencing these problems, then I would not recommend installing CU1. It might undergo additional testing, yada, yada, yada. Just to note, something else that we're still looking at. This might be familiar to a lot of you. KB2894518 lists out software updates or Windows updates that cause multiple reboots. So if you're installing updates during your task sequence, and one or more of them requires the system to reboot and then reboot again. After the first reboot, well, the task sequence will start up and it and our client will start it up and they'll think it'll want to start processing again. And then the computer will reboot again. So it's effectively an unknown reboot. We don't control that reboot. We don't know about that reboot. So after the system comes back up, we haven't saved our state. We're not able to restart. So that KB article will list those updates that have this functionality, and steps on how to mitigate that. So we're looking at, we obviously need to have a better plan here. So we're both looking at how we can handle that inside of the task sequence. And we're also having some conversations with the Windows folks in terms of how we can better detect when this happens. Today, it's the support folks identify it, they update the KB article. That's more reactive. We should be able to proactively determine whether an update is going to do that and handle it appropriately. Let me talk about upgrade for a little bit. So what is upgrade? Upgrade is going from an older version of the OS to a newer version of the OS. It's called an in-place upgrade sometimes. Running setup.exe from the existing system. And on the other end, you get to the new OS. Well, the cool thing is that with Windows 8.1 upgrade, if you're going from Windows 8 to Windows 8.1, that will upgrade the OS, but it'll keep the applications, it'll keep the user data, and it'll keep the settings. You don't have to do anything. It just does it. No USMT. It's also fast. I've seen it as low as 15 minutes. I'm being a little conservative here with my numbers. But still, 20 or 30 minutes to effectively refresh an OS without having to worry about the apps and the data and the settings, that's a good deal. And one of my colleagues on the Windows team who works a lot with this has referred to a rollback as bulletproof. Now, hopefully that sounds like a challenge. It did to me when I first heard it. So he's been working with this technology for like 5 years, and they do a lot of upgrades. They do it like thousands and thousands of upgrades. He's seen rollback fail twice, and that was internal only on some test systems where they're doing some crazy stuff, some wacky stuff. We've never seen an instance of rollback failing in the wild. Rollback is as upgrade is occurring, if for some reason it's not able to continue, it rolls back to the existing OS in a fully functional state as it was. So let's say you're on Windows 8, users on Windows 8, you deploy the upgrade goes off the rails, it'll roll back to a fully functional state in Windows 8. So the user might have a couple minutes of downtime while the system tries to do the upgrade, it's not able to, the user's still able to keep running. So in a normal OS deployment with a refresh, if it fails in the middle, you know, if you've gone past the point of wiping the disk, and something fails, they're dead in the water. Someone's got to come out and lay hands on that system in order to get it functional again. So that's a really cool thing. Why do I say that? Well, internally, there was a proof of concept of this last summer. There's a new switch for setup that allows it to happen automatically. So they could deploy it in such a way that basically the users didn't have to really do anything. They didn't have to nurse that upgrade. It would happen just in one go. Well, they deployed it using Config Manager, but as an application. So they deployed an OS, a bunch of content, 3.5 gigs of content, along with a command line, setup.exe, /auto-upgrade, a few others. So, you know, as Config Manager goes, it's pretty good at deploying a bunch of content with a command line. So there's no task sequence involved. There's no OS deployment, other functionality here, just an application. On the other end of it, the problem here is that setup runs, and then in the down-level OS, setup runs, and then it restarts. The client, most of the time, isn't really able to detect that too well. So in some cases, it might be able to get a return code. Some cases, it might not. Some cases, it might be able to detect that the process terminates, sometimes not. But then on the other end of it, in R2, we actually made some revisions to the client so that the client will detect when the OS version has changed underneath it. It'll go through a repair process, make sure all of its components are good, reevaluate policy, and it'll be happy. So this was really successful. They did a lot of clients. They had a 97% success rate, and they reduced help desk calls by 48%. So this was a pretty cool thing. There's documentation up on the IT showcase, both a quick reference guide that gives an overview of the process, as well as a technical white paper that goes into a lot more detail about how the application was configured. They used a PowerShell script to kind of wrap around it, status messages, reporting, all that sort of good stuff. Well, cool, right? Yes and no. I should say, yes, it's very cool. But if you're going to consider this, I want to make sure you got all of the details. So first, this will only work on R2. I wouldn't recommend even trying it on another platform. That was the only one that was it was tested with. So it was tested internal to Microsoft for a lot of clients, but it was all R2. And as I mentioned, the client has some revisions in it to detect that upgrade. Other clients will not. It's only work if you're going from Windows 8 to Windows 8.1, or Windows 8.1 update, sorry. So if you are currently on Windows 8, if you have a large segment of Windows 8 users and you need to get to Windows 8.1 update, this is something to consider. If you're on another platform, not a good solution today. I say multiple languages here, but really this is talking about content, and it's talking about the three categories to consider with content that affects the WIM size or the WIMs that you use. Language is a big one. So if you're deploying English OS, let's say you're also deploying German, French, right? I'm talking about the base OS, not language packs, but the base OS. Well, you also need to take in consideration the architecture, x86, x64. If you're deploying both, you're doubling your content. Also, addition. If you're deploying enterprise, if you're deploying pro, you're doubling your content. So then across all of that, you could potentially have a lot of content that you're deploying. Internally, we did, I think it was both x86 and x64 across 5 languages. So there were effectively 10 WIMs. The full content size was upwards of like 50 gigs or something. So you then have to make sure that content is well managed, that it's staged on distribution points appropriately, that you scaled your distribution points to accommodate the load. Again, we were talking 80,000 clients, so it's a lot of systems all happening at once. Another thing to keep in mind, I don't have on the slide here, is, you know, Microsoft's a unique organization, to say the least. You know, a lot of technical users who want to be on the latest and greatest, and they're very eager for that. So internally, when we started to socialize this and make it available, there was a huge demand. So they really had to scale things up and make it as solid as possible out of the gate, because they knew that there would be a huge influx. Even though things were staged across different regions and different organizations, it was still just a huge flood of demand. Device targeting will make this easier. And making it an available deployment will make it easier. So the users then can go to the software center, they can see that it's available, and they can install it at their leisure. If you do it as required, make sure you're staging that appropriately and not doing it all at once. Don't deploy to all systems. If you are doing available, I would also recommend staging it, or at least staging the communication, so that you're only telling segments of users, hey, go get the download now, go get the update now. MSIT internally use the company portal. So if you look at the documentation on IT Showcase, it'll talk about the company portal. And honestly, it is a better user experience. You can go to the company portal as a modern app. You can see that the 8.1 update is there as a featured item. And then it's just a couple of clicks to initiate the installation. In the background, that's using the application catalog, which in this scenario, with the number of clients and the breadth of the hierarchy and the amount of content that's happening here, it was a big stress on the application catalog servers. So making sure that those are scaled appropriately, using a remote site system for the application catalog server, making sure that each site has its own application catalog, and making sure that the clients are properly associated with that application catalog server in the site. I would hope this goes without saying, but really any deployment you do to a large number of systems at once with this much content, you could have some performance issues, right? There's a lot of policy that's coming down, there's a lot of content that's coming down, but then with the application too, there's a lot of state that's going back up. So the application install will be sending state messages back up. You need to make sure that you're watching for any state message backlogs on your site server, any backlogs in general on the site server, performance of the DPs, performance on the MPs, as well as the application catalog servers if you're using them. If you have multiple sites and you have clients that are roaming between sites, this can cause problems in this scenario as they're trying to contact an application server, application catalog server, sorry, that's on a different site. So then in a multi-site hierarchy as well, there are potential for replication issues, both in terms of the policy, the deployment policy that comes down, as well as the state messages that then flow back up to making sure you get good reporting. So it's a lot of things that you need to think about. You need to look at your hierarchy and make sure it's well designed to handle all of those flows. As I mentioned, the update kind of rolls off the cliff, and setup.exe will exit and restart the computer to continue the low-level upgrade of the kernel. The client may not be able to capture that. Depending upon what happens there, and unfortunately, it's non-deterministic, so you won't be able to say for sure how that will behave. It depends upon how the processes are killed before it restarts. Our client might be killed before setup is actually killed. So depending upon how that is ordered, the client may or may not know about it, and then it may or may not have enough time to actually send state back up. So then depending upon how that happens, after the upgrade, after the client goes through its reevaluation and repair, it may or may not send state right away. If the app had failed, and if it was able to detect that the app had failed, the client will wait to reevaluate until it reevaluates its full policy. So by default, that's 7 days. So if you deploy the upgrade, it could theoretically be 7 days before you hear back from that system and know that it was successful. Your console will show in progress or failure. Actually, in this case, it would show failure. And you won't know for a week that it's actually good. So internally, they upped that to 1 day to ensure they get more rapid response. Obviously, there's additional impact that would cause. Clients are now pinging the MP once a day, so you have to have additional load for your MP, make sure that's scaled appropriately. As I mentioned, the admin may see failure states, may see a long-running in progress, or may actually see that the application failed, when in actuality it didn't. It went into a state that we didn't capture. Eventually that should resolve, but there is this period of radio silence where you don't know what's going on. So for some administrators or for some folks who do reporting, managers who are looking at reports, that may not be a good thing. In the scenario that we did internally, we don't use cloud DPs and we're not using HTTPS in this environment. So cloud DPs, I know that there is an issue with certificates after the upgrade. There is an easy mitigation for that, but it will cause the client to not be able to communicate with the cloud DPs after the OS is upgraded. Because of that, I'm extrapolating that may also then be an issue in a secure site. Not something we tested, so I'm not 100% sure. It's just a theory. But it's something then that would need to be considered. Okay. So I gave you all of the great things about upgrade, and I gave you all the reality of what it might actually take to get there, and some of the requirements. So what do I recommend? If you have a bunch of Windows 8 systems and you want to get the 8.1 update, how do you do it? Honestly, the primary recommendation is refresh. Do a wipe and load. We know it works. We know it's supported. It's a well-known beast, right? That's how Config Manager today is supporting OS deployments. We know this works though, right? We did a huge test internally. And we're looking at better ways of doing this in the future. So we have a lot of conversations going on right now, both internally on the OSD team, as well as with Windows, on how we can make this a better experience in the future. So I look forward to being able to talk more about this in the future. But for right now, all I can say is, we're looking at it, and we're going to make this better in the future. If you do go down this road and you think, you know what, I really like all of the advantages, and I'm okay with some of these things, or it doesn't apply to me, yeah, great. It's a great process. But make sure you consider it carefully, look at all these caveats, compare it against your environment, and then test the heck out of it, and be sure that it'll work for you. I'm not going to spend much time here because it's very much the same as what I said on the MDT slide. If you are on R2, We recommend you upgrade the ADK. You don't have to. It's not required. Everything's still supported as is. You can keep rocking and rolling. If you do upgrade, you don't need to update your boot images. You do need to update your USMT package. Windows PE 5.1, we don't support it. We don't have a way to be able to walk through that process to generate that PE 5.1 image. And if you're going to be servicing, if you're going to be deploying it, get the latest ISO. Same story with servicing. You can do offline servicing of an 8.1 image to add the update, but we can't guarantee the ordering if you do it all in one shot. So you need to go through offline service and add the prereq, let that process, go back, do offline servicing, and add the update, okay? You need to make sure you do the ordering correctly by going through a whole offline servicing process. You could do it as a package and deploying that way if you want to do it online as part of the task sequence. This is especially good with language packs. You need to make sure that the update is applied after your language packs. That's standard, documented, supported methodology, is that if you're installing updates and language packs, you install the language packs first, and then you install the updates. Again, you can always do it manually if you really love DISM on the command line. And again, or you can just get the latest ISO and do that, because that is a lot easier. Again, WinBoot, not supported because we don't have a way to get that Windows PE 5.1 image in there. Something that we're looking at and we're talking about, but today with R2, WinBoot is not supported with Config Manager. And as the same with MDT, this is detailed up on our blog. Got a lot more detail on this, so go look at that there. Last slide, or last content slide, my slide. XP and a life. XP support retired last month. Hopefully that's not a newsflash to anybody. So what do you do? I know there are still customers, I'm talking to customers every day that still have some pockets of XP, and they are working to get rid of them. So you can refresh those to Windows 7. I know a lot of customers that are still doing that. As the icon shows, you're breaking our heart, but I know a lot of customers are doing it. You could refresh that to Windows 8, and then you could upgrade your Windows 8 to 8.1. You could do that all as one big process. It should work. It's a little hairy. It's a lot of churn on the system, but it's technically possible. Or you can just refresh straight from XP to 8.1. with some caveats. So go check out, if you want to head in that direction and go straight from XP to 8.1, check out the blog here on how to do that. There's some specific constraints around how you do that, and that just relates to the supportability of the tools and how they work. But it's all fully documented there, and that's the supported process. Mike also figured out a way to do that using MDT. It's on his personal blog, not a supported process. But he found that would work. So we're just into the related content. I'll let you look at this offline. This is all the PCIT stuff. I wanted to call out a couple from Monday, the infrastructure session that Jim did, as well as that MVP panel. That was I sat in the back of that. It was a great session. They went into some great detail. Jason had a great bit on MP selection, which was great. And then Johan had a bit on OSD with some great detail on that. So I recommend you check out that if you missed it. Hands-on lab, or this instructor-led lab, looks like there's one tomorrow at 1:00. I think Wally's doing those this year still on deploying Windows 8.1. And then there's a hands-on lab as well. If you missed the instructor-led and you wanna go through the lab, that's available. All of our resources. Please, even regardless of the Xbox or the gift cards, or whatever, please do an eval or hit up on Twitter and give me some feedback or shoot me an email or come see me afterwards. But the evaluation is good because it gives some quantitative data. Give me some comments if you liked it, what you thought could go better, what you thought didn't go so well, maybe. It's good to have some actionable feedback. If I want to do this again in the future, or they let me do this again in the future, especially if you liked it. If you didn't like it, hey, let me know. I'd love to hear your feedback. It's really important. And that's all I have. Thanks for your time. Thanks for coming. I appreciate you coming here instead of one of the other ones. But check those out on recording. I'll be around for a few minutes if there's any questions. And I'll be around most of the day tomorrow, too, if you want to come find me. So thanks for your time, guys.